Hey, I'm Jeremiah, and this is Christian Anarchy. Hopefully, you are already privy to all of this information, because if not, it means you're starting with this episode. In which case, you will most likely be confused. But your confusion is on you, man. You never start with episode 16. Everyone knows that. We begin with concluding remarks. Break up the pieces and examine the parts. Your words always cut when they're cliche. But here's my knife because I came for the buffet. This is the way it goes when you are part of it. Nervously saying words, fiddle surprising bed. A mark beneath the chin. I've caught you once again. It's in the way you say. Big shout out and thank you to the band Emery for coming in and playing live every week to introduce the podcast. You guys are very generous with your time. I'll see you all next week. To the rest of you, welcome. I hope you are doing well. Today we'll be continuing on with Romans 13 and finishing up. I won't deal any more with this text unless someone asks me questions about it or makes the attempt to rebut what I have presented. Last week I primarily deconstructed the text and demonstrated convincingly, I might add, that it's not necessary to read Romans 13 and conclude that God loves government, government is necessary, or that government is good, or that government is something that is always going to be or always needs to be in place. This week, I'll spend a little bit of time affirming that just kind of throughout this podcast, but I primarily want to reconstruct the text to show what it does mean and what it is trying to communicate, or at least some of what it's trying to communicate. Obviously, Paul wrote it for a reason, and the text means something, and I don't feel good about just deconstructing it and then leaving it without putting forth an honest interpretation of what the text does actually mean and is trying to teach us. I think the preceding context of Romans 13 is a necessary part of understanding what comes next. So I'll read Romans 12, verses 14 through 21, and then we'll get into Romans 13 a little bit more. Romans 12, verses 14 through 21 says, "Bless those who persecute you. Bless and do not curse them. Rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. Never be wise in your own sight. Repay no one evil for evil, but give thought to do what is honorable in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink. For by doing so, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." We actually went through the text, I think, in episode 5 or 6 about pacifism. So if it sounds familiar, it might be from that. There are a few concepts in Romans 12 which help form an important backdrop for Romans 13. Paul says to bless those who persecute you. This is a part of the idea of overcoming evil with good and not responding to people who are being negative toward you with the same negativity. Don't respond to persecution with persecution, because this won't do anything to end persecution. Instead, seek to make even your enemy your friend. Along with this idea is Paul's exhortation to never avenge yourselves, but to let God take care of it. Paul's assurance is that followers of Jesus can trust God to bring justice when they have been wrong. He'll take care of it, and they need not worry about it. They don't have to, and shouldn't, participate in the never-ending, violent circle of human revenge. The third idea to keep in mind from this passage is about living peaceably with all insofar as it depends on you. Paul wants Christians to do what they can within their power to have peaceful relationships with others. He doesn't want them to be a part of violent revolts or to set their hearts on revenge. Their job is to help make the world more peaceful, not to participate in its destruction. So with these related themes in mind, let's enter into Romans 13, Romans 13:1 says, "Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God." Hopefully, with Romans 12 fresh in your mind, when you hear the first verse of Romans 13, you already have an idea of where I'm going with the interpretation of it. Paul tells the Roman Christians to bless those who persecute you, then shortly after, tells them to be subject to the governing authorities. Guess who is most likely to be persecuting Christians? Government authorities. Many thousands of Christians at this time were imprisoned, beaten, and killed by local and national governing authorities. A part of what Paul is doing here is making the exhortations of Romans 12 specific. Bless those who persecute you is a very general statement. But when Paul starts talking about the government, the picture becomes more specific and more clear. By bringing up the governing authorities, the Romans are now thinking about a specific persecutor and the nature of their persecution. It's a personalization of Romans 12. Part of blessing those who persecute you is being subject to the governing authorities. Bless them through being subject to them despite their persecution of you. This is also related to living peaceably with all. It is another part of encouraging followers of Jesus to be at peace as much as they can with others. What living peaceably looks like in relationship to government is to subject oneself to them as much as one can without violating their own conscience. Of course, neither of these suggestions for Christian behavior should be read to come into conflict with the idea that government is evil. It is simply outlining the proper response for Jesus' followers in the face of this evil. Bless when they persecute, and work to live peaceably even though the government isn't all that peaceful. As for the being instituted by God bit, perhaps you remember some stuff from last week about the idea of authorities being instituted by God. A brief reminder of two main points from last episode. First, the word for instituted and appointed in Romans 13 can also be translated orchestrated or ordered. This shift in translation would then make God out not to be the one who initiated the setting up of these authorities, but the one who is organizing these authorities, who have already been put into place by others. Second, we have already seen in the story of when God placed a king over Israel that God can and God does institute authorities over people that he never wanted to be over them in the first place. He simply chooses to participate with people and work within their choices to bring the most good, even when he doesn't support their choices, like their choice to have a king. So God can institute rulers without wanting rulers because God meets humanity where they are at. And if they are at a place where they are instituting systems of rulers, God will be there to work within whatever system they set up. By pointing out God's involvement in the government, Paul is trying to encourage Christians to continue to do whatever is in their power to live peaceably with the government, despite their persecution. The goal of a follower of Jesus is to follow Jesus. You're welcome for my pointing out of this particularly piercing insight. And the follower of Jesus is willing to risk themselves to accomplish the will of God on earth. The follower of Jesus trusts in God's power and trusts if God needed to, he could remove the rulers, but God hasn't removed them yet. Therefore, Jesus' followers can be confident God can accomplish his purposes even with whatever rulers are in power. They can then assertively work under whomever is ruling them, with God and each other, in the process of their own transformation and in the process of transforming the world, knowing God will use whatever circumstances may arise for their ultimate good. Paul's reference to God's activity with the rulers is intended as a faith booster. Romans 13 verse 2 says, "Therefore, whoever resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. This sentence is a simple statement of fact. God is organizing these rulers, and resisting them is a resistance of what God is orchestrating. The text is not trying to communicate that all resistance of government is bad, or even necessarily that most is. If it were, then Paul must have forgot about all the times he and Jesus resisted government. And we would have to conclude, anyone who resisted government actions, even actions as heinous as government-instituted slavery, was dishonoring God and disobeying him. The text is instead speaking to the simple reality. If you're not doing what the government tells you to do, expect them to respond with judgment. This is the way governments behave, and don't anticipate them behaving differently. They aren't going to allow you to disobey without repercussions. Romans 13, verses 3 through 4 say, "For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of the one who is in authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive his approval, for he is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer." These verses outline what God is orchestrating and organizing the government authorities to do. God is working within their free will to make them a terror to bad conduct. God wants the government to be a deterrent to bad behavior in a society. Insofar as the government is punishing bad behavior and rewarding good behavior, good for them. Certainly, it's helpful for the stabilization of the world. However, let's not read too much into the text and then assume this is the only thing God can use to be a terror to bad conduct, or the only thing God will use. He uses it now because it exists. But just because God is capable of using evil systems to do good, neither justifies the existence of such systems, nor is evidence of God's approval of them. He's just creative. Like us, people in first century Rome had thieves and murderers and others who did bad things to violate people's rights. Often in Rome, it was the governing authorities who brought those types of people to court, convicted them, and put them in prison or executed them. They were familiar with governments bringing people to justice and had seen wrongdoers dealt with by government. Paul frames this type of government action as being from God. In Romans 12, Paul tells followers of Jesus to leave the revenge to God rather than taking it themselves. In Romans 13, Paul explains that one of the tools God has and uses to execute this vengeance is the government. By framing good things government does, like helping bring justice sometimes, as an act of God, Paul encourages people to give glory to God for the punishment of the wrongdoer and not to the government. When the government is in actuality being a terror to bad conduct and rewarding good conduct, then the government is being a servant of God, and Christians should do what the government wants. Clearly, Paul wants Christians to do good and not to do wrong, but doing good and avoiding bad doesn't necessarily mean doing everything the government wants. Right and wrong exist outside of and regardless of whatever government edicts might say. This is probably getting repetitive, but I'll again point out, Paul is not saying obeying the government is always doing what is good, or that disobeying is always doing what is bad. Paul is saying when the government is fulfilling the role of punishing wrong behavior, then Christians should expect to be punished by the government for misbehavior and approved when they are doing good. Paul doesn't deny there are times when the government punishes people for good behavior. The course of Paul's life evidences this strongly. Government often acts in ways where people should not only be afraid when they do wrong, but also when they are doing right. Paul's argument here is in these cases, when the government is acting in a manner opposite to what Paul described, then they are no longer acting as a servant of God, but as one who is opposing God. I think Romans 13 helps analyze what sort of government behavior we should accept and what sort of behavior we should reject and criticize. It also helps us figure out what sorts of government actions might occasion a fitting time for civil disobedience. When we can point out very specifically areas where government is doing evil toward others, then it is fitting for the follower of Jesus to point out how they are acting contrary to how they would be acting if they were serving God, and to oppose them in these areas, because then they aren't fulfilling their role of being a servant of God any longer. What this opposition looks like will vary greatly depending on the time period, person, and the actions they are standing against. Romans 13, verses 5 and 6 say, therefore, one must be in subjection, not only to avoid God's wrath, but also for the sake of conscience. For because of this, you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God, attending to this very thing. In these passages, Paul calls the authorities both servants of God and ministers of God. It is common when we read passages like this now to see these terms as a really high praise of the government authorities and rulers. To some of the more local rulers in Judea, like the rulers of local synagogues and even in the temple, this likely would have been considered high praise. The Hebrew religious authorities would have readily taken the label of being a servant of God. However, Paul is writing to the Romans. The Roman authorities are primarily non-Jewish, neither in ethnicity nor religion. Rome is the location of not only many local pagan government authorities, but also of the Senate and Caesar himself. Paul is writing to the Romans about these authorities specifically, who not only don't have love for the God of the Jews, they have a particular distaste for the Jewish belief in him as the only true God. These are the rulers Paul calls servants of God. We aren't always inclined to read it this way, but this is a very subversive way of talking about these authorities. Roman authorities aren't really into being servants or priests. The highest of them, the Caesar, and a few times in Roman history, liked to refer to himself as the Son of God, making him equal with God and a God himself. But calling him a minister, putting him on the same level as a priest, would not have gone over well. The real kicker is that Paul does not here refer to these Roman authorities as servants of their gods. He is not calling them servants and ministers of Jupiter, the highest god in the Roman pantheon. Paul is calling them servants of Yahweh. He refers to them as servants of the Jewish God. They are ministers of the God of the people they conquered, the God they don't even think exists. This is incredibly insulting to the vast majority of Roman rulers. Not only would Roman authorities be offended when called servants of the Jewish God, but calling them servants and ministers of this God also puts these rulers on the same level as the church in Rome. Guess who else Paul calls servants of God? He calls himself a servant. He calls the people of the church servants of God. Who are God's ministers? Yes, the authorities, and also the followers of Jesus. Paul applies the same titles to the people of the church as he does to Roman rulers. With respect to God, both his people and the rulers of nations are in the same place. They are equals. Even Paul's titles in this text serve to undermine the sense of superiority of the Roman rulers and illustrates the picture of them being in subjection to someone else. The text talks about being in subjection because of fear of punishment and also because of conscience. Just prior, the text talks about the government punishing wrongdoers, so the point is people should not do what is wrong because of their own conscience. Paul doesn't mean people should always be in subjection because of their conscience, but their conscience should convict them to do what is right, And insofar as the government rewards what is right and punishes what is wrong, then doing what is right is subjection to the government. If conscience is a reason for being subject to the governing authorities sometimes, then it also is a reason for not being subject to them sometimes. Our conscience should cause us to act rightly, regardless of external forces, even governments. Our conscience should cause us to act rightly when government punishes bad behavior, and when government punishes good behavior. Thoughtlessly living in subjection to governments is ignorant of the historical and present evil of governments, and ignorant of our own conscience. If a conscience causes someone to be in subjection to governments all the time, then it's not really their conscience guiding them, unless they happen to live under the perfect government. I do think there are a lot of neutral laws and demands of government which Christians should live in subjection to, as a general rule. Being subjected to laws which don't require us to go against our conscience, but which are not necessarily good, just kind of neutral, is a part of living peaceably with all. There's nothing inherently good about going the speed limit, and nothing evil about going faster than it. Still, to live peaceably with all, insofar as it depends on us, even enemies, even persecutors, even those who oppress, it makes sense for the Christian to voluntarily subject themselves to such morally neutral laws, unless they have a good moral reason for breaking them. This subjection is not about legitimizing government authority. It's about being a peacemaker in the world. I think our disruptions of government are more powerful and will be more powerful when they aren't about petty grievances. And as far as taxes, well, I pay my taxes. I do not do so because I think the government is acting like a servant of God in the world most of the time. I think the opposite is true quite often. They often reward bad behavior and punish good behavior. Because of this, I don't feel any sense of conviction to give them money for how well they've been ministers to the world. I pay my taxes because if I don't, they'll take my home, take my resources, and lock me in a cage. If I defend any of these things, they'll kill me. So the fear of death keeps my money flowing their way. If the governing authorities allowed people to only pay for the services they wanted from them, like any organization which isn't evil does, then I would willingly pay them for services rendered. I would voluntarily pay them for being a terror to bad conduct and for whatever good they were bringing into the world. But as it is, I think government is such a net negative that their acquisition of more resources so they can do more functions to make the world worse. All right, final verse of Romans 13, verse 7. Pay to all what is owed to them, taxes to whom taxes are owed, revenue to whom revenue is owed, respect to whom respect is owed, honor to whom honor is owed. There are a couple of questions I think are important to keep in mind about verse 7. The verse is a twofold question, so maybe there's a few questions to keep in mind about verse 7. The first question is, who decides who is owed what and how much they are owed? The people Paul is talking to have to make such decisions about what they owe to whom. Everyone has to decide for themselves who they owe something to and the amount they owe. They don't have to make these decisions alone, but should probably have a conversation with the person who thinks they are owed to figure it out. Ultimately, it's the individual who has to make such decisions about what it looks like to pay to all what is owed them. This doesn't mean all such decisions are subjective. If I go to the store and purchase a carton of milk, it's objectively clear I owe the store the amount of money the milk was priced at. $2.49 at Quick Trip as of September 24, 2015, in case posterity requires such information. Other situations are subjective. Let's say I make an agreement with someone who provides a service for me at a particular price. What if they provide the service, then say some unforeseeable circumstances required more work to be done, and the service costed them more, and thus they need to charge more? Then what do I owe them? The first price we agreed upon beforehand, or the new price? Many factors will weigh into my decision, but the final decision will be made by me and my own conscience. Individuals are the ultimate determiner of deciding what they owe to whom. What about taxation? How does one decide to whom taxes are owed and how much money is owed? While this may seem to be immediately evident for some, it is not for all. I understand the initial impulse is to simply say people owe taxes to the government, and they owe as much as the government says they owe them. This way of looking at it is common because it is the message given to people from birth to death, and rarely does anyone hear an even halfway decently thought out counter perspective. You're welcome for that, by the way. For those of us who have spent some time considering the arbitrary nature of the government, it's not so simple. The government is an organization composed of people who call themselves a government. There's no magical enchantment that occurs in the formation of a government which imbues this organization with the right to tax. I could write myself a constitution, call myself a government, go to my neighbor's house, tell them they owe me taxes because I swept their sidewalk and I've been watching their yard periodically to keep them safe. The fundamental difference between me doing this and another government doing it is only that my organization is smaller than theirs. I have as much right to tax as government does. The second question I think is important to ask about this verse is, what does it look like to show respect and honor? It's pretty clear taxes and revenue have to do with giving people money. Treating people with respect and honor is not so cut and dried. Respecting and honoring people definitely looks like not initiating violence against them. It would also be dishonoring to mock a person or belittle them. Some things are clear. Respect and honor are about treating people like equals, people who are of great value and worth because they are made in God's image. However, respect is not about treating people like they are better than you. It certainly doesn't look like doing everything someone asks you to do all the time. If I am in a position where I am following every single rule someone sets out for me and doing whatever they ask, no matter how silly or how much it affects me, it is not because I have a lot of respect for the person or want to honor them. It's because I'm either afraid of them, or I know I only have to endure such obsequious obedience for a short while, and it would be more of a pain for me to object. Respect and honor do not mean simple obedience. People in power tend to use the ideas of respect and honor this way. To young people, it is not uncommon for older people to tell them to respect their elders. When they say this, they often mean something like, don't argue with me, do what I say, or treat me like your superior. None of these things have to do with respect. We are told to honor our parents, but some people take this idea of parent honoring to mean we must always treat our parents like they are our bosses, or we should let our parents be condescending to us, or passive-aggressive, or controlling, or we should never tell our parents when we think they're wrong. But treating our parents this way would not be honorable at all. If you respect someone, you think well of them. You think them to be a morally capable person, someone who has the ability to treat others with kindness and love. Honoring someone is to treat them like a person who is honorable, who is strong, who is capable of handling confrontation or disagreements like an adult. It would be disrespectful and dishonoring to watch someone seriously mistreat others and not say something to them about it. If you remain silent, you would be treating them as if they were someone who either couldn't handle you pointing it out without freaking out, or like they were ethically incapable of treating others well at all. That would not be a very respectful way of perceiving someone. The more well I know someone and the more respect I have for them, the more likely I will be to adamantly disagree with them. the more strongly I will promote peace with them and work to convince them to reject the aggressive violence of the state. I have enough respect for the people in government and those who support it to call out its evil. I treat the governing authorities with honor. I treat them like ethically capable adults who can think, process, and understand. It is in part this respect and this honor that drives me to continuously call out their evil. That's enough for me on Romans 13. We have other things to talk about in the future. I hope that this was helpful for some of you. I hope it was helpful for all of you. And I hope that some of you have received some new insights into the text. And maybe even some of you no longer feel that Romans 13 is incongruent with Christian anarchy. If you have any thoughts, questions, comments, rebuttals, requests for clarification, or you just want to say hi, you can email me at jeremiahjm@gmail.com. To listen to past episodes or to discover some more resources, you can go to www.christianarchy.net. And I will be back next week to talk to you about something. I'm not sure what it is yet, but I'm sure it will be riveting. I appreciate your time and your willingness to process new ideas or old ideas from my mouth. I hope you have a lovely day and a lovely week. Be a peacemaker.